Okay, so as Rob just told you, I've been at the IQC for about 2 years now. I'm setting up a new experimental effort. We're going to be doing ion trap quantum computing, and the scope of these experiments is fairly large, so it takes a couple of years to get them going. For that reason, the talk that I'm giving today is all about what we want to do in the lab, and there is not a scrap of experimental data in sight. So we're just going to be telling you about how cool our experiments might be if we ever get them working. And I promise you, I believe they're going to work, but I can't actually prove that yet. So I want to start off by. Is this too loud? Okay. I'd like to start off by giving an overview of trapped ion quantum computing for those of you who are unfamiliar with it. I'll then tell you a little bit about our justifications that we make for why do we want to go to all the trouble of developing a multi-level quantum system. And then I'll go through the experimental steps that we need to take in order to demonstrate some of the basic operations that will be needed. So trapped ion quantum computers are one of the two most mature technologies out there, and I'll elaborate on what that means in a minute. But I find that a lot of people like to have some kind of a visual. What does this thing look like? What do I mean when I say a trapped ion quantum computer? So I'm hoping that I don't have to describe the concept of a qubit to everyone here. I'll just skip right over that one. But assuming that I want to encode a qubit in some physical system, the way that we're doing it in the trapped ion platform is we take a single atomic ion and we encode the qubit states in typically the spin states of the valence electron. And when we set up our experiments, typically we run our ions in a linear chain. That tends to be the easiest thing for us to do to get started with. And as you can see, this is actually a live, well, not live, this is a picture of the fluorescence coming off of about 16 trapped ions. They're separated by about 2 microns in the middle here, and that's a distance which we can easily resolve with optical microscopy. In order to make them trapped ions as opposed to just ions, we use sometimes fairly complicated electrode structures, but they are charged particles, and so we can electrically trap them. And of course, we want to isolate them very well from the environment, so we put them inside of a vacuum chamber. Typically, a vacuum chamber that's used for trapped ions would have actually windows on it, but this is a photo of one that's in preparation in my lab right now, and the first step involved not having glass there. But imagine that there was glass there. That's what the vacuum chamber will look like eventually. And then most of the manipulations that we do, or practically all of them, are laser-based. So around the vacuum chamber, we build up a whole sprawling set of optics. And I like stealing this picture from my graduate lab because it has even more optics and scary looking stuff than what's in my lab at the moment. So when I say that ions are a fairly mature technology, what I mean is that we can put together a quantum processor with a handful of qubits. Right now, the most advanced published results are around, depending on how you want to define it, 5 to 20 qubits. And when people ask me the question of how many qubits can you deal with, of course, I always have to answer, well, how well do you want me to be able to control them? Because I could claim that the electrons in this pointer here were all qubits, but I wouldn't find that a very useful system because I can't do anything with them. So this is sort of a sampling of what people are doing across the world. The top groups are able to achieve really, really high fidelities with single qubit gates and 2 qubit gates. They're able to control maybe dozens or even hundreds of ions, but not to the same extent. And so everybody in this field is trying to push this line kind of up to the top right here. And the thing that I'm going to be telling you about is more actually extending a third dimension. Maybe we'll have to have a 3D plot coming out of the screen here. And so why do we like trapped ions for quantum computing is that they're extremely well isolated. They're extremely clean. We can get very high coherence times, up to 10 minutes, or even 15 in some experiments. And as I said, the error rates that we can achieve with the quantum gates are extremely low as well. Another thing that's very convenient about ion traps is that the way that we do our two-qubit gates, the entangling interactions, is using this long-range Coulomb interaction between the ions. And what that means for us is that we can perform an entangling gate between any pair of ions in a trap. And you can start to see that this is important, even for a system as small as 5 qubits. I'm showing here on the bottom a graph from a comparison between a University of Maryland experiment with trapped ions and an IBM quantum experience program, where they were running the same algorithm. All of the benchmarks are the same in the sense that the individual gate fidelities are all the same. But you can see that the ions performed better here, and the reason is that we were able, or not we, they were able to connect directly any pair of qubits and not have to swap information through the middle one at any point. So this is going to be more of an issue as we try scaling up these systems to larger numbers, and we hope that it's going to be advantageous for us working with trapped ions, because we will have a fully connected interaction graph even with larger numbers. Okay, and what I also said at the beginning is that in addition to using trapped ions, we want to actually change our approach. We want to do something really new now. And the basic rationale is, kind of dumb sounding, right? We have a trapped ion, which has some internal structure here, which I'm not, I think, hitting with my laser pointer. And we go to great pains to isolate two of the states within that ion. And we say, okay, I want to have a zero state, I want to have a one state, and I want everything else to just go away, and I want it to leave me alone, and I want to never talk to that again. That seems a little bit silly, actually, if we have the control to do more than that, because it's hard to put more ions into a chain. It's hard to scale up your system. And so it would make sense to start encoding more information in each ion, especially since, you know, there's these convenient extra states that are just hanging out there waiting for us to try to play with them. The problem with it is nobody really has the techniques and tools developed. So we have to really redevelop everything from scratch. And that's one of the reasons why I have no experimental data to show you, is because we've spent the last year or so really thinking through very carefully how do we do all of the very basic operations that you're going to need to do quantum computing with these qubits. Okay, so there are several difficulties, obviously, with going to multiple level systems. Otherwise, somebody would have done it by now. The reason that some people will throw at me first is they'll say, well, you have a lot more decoherence when you have more than two states. You can't play any of the games that we sometimes play to get rid of decoherence that's caused by magnetic field noise. Then another issue that we ran into in the first set of experiments I was doing back in Maryland is that we only had a binary measurement technique. So we wanted to measure the internal state of our ion, and we had a tool that would give us, you know, a yes or a no answer. And a yes or a no answer doesn't tell you which of three states or which of five states the ion is sitting in. So that part's a little bit problematic. It doesn't give you enough information to really know what you're doing. And obviously, you're going to need more controls and so forth. So for those reasons, we feel like it's necessary to justify why we're putting in this effort a little bit beyond just saying, oh, yeah, let me wave my hands around and say, obviously, we can put more information in these ions. Well, obviously, that would be kind of the first step, is to say, yes, we can put more information in the ions. And in particular, we can provably use the multidimensional qubits for quantum operations and quantum algorithms in much the same way that you would with qubits. Typically, you're going to need fewer of these qubits. And that brings me to one of the first reasons why we think this may be advantageous in the future. Because if you go back to this slide here, I didn't highlight it at the time, but it's much easier to do very precise operations on a single ion than it is to entangle two ions. The error rates are much, much higher when you want to try to take two ions and make them talk to each other. So if we can take a quantum algorithm and put some of the complexity into manipulating a single ion, it seems plausible that we'll get much better error rates. You would have to convince me that it's possible to actually do that, to simplify and to shrink down the number of qubits that you need by adding more levels. And there's not a whole lot of work out there that I have found, but you can find a few examples where people have gone through and said, okay, here's, for example, the number of qudits. I'm having trouble with that today, apparently. The number of qudits that you would need on the vertical axis to obtain a given precision in a quantum phase estimation algorithm. And it does appear that, you know, as you add more states to your ions, you get some improvements here. You maybe get to cut the number of ions that you need in half. So that's all nice and potentially beneficial in the future. But to me, the thing that seems most intriguing, although it's also the thing I know the least about, is that there are several papers out there and several people who will say that error correction may become easier when you have more levels available. So for example, magic state distillation is thought to require a friendlier error threshold if you have more than two states available. And my hope would be that eventually we might be able to show that there is a practical improvement, that we could improve error-correcting codes and make fault-tolerant quantum computing more plausible by using these multi-level qudits. But as you'll see in a second, that's kind of a long way away. I'm really just trying to give you sort of the broad motivation as to why we want to start wading into this field before I go back to the very basics of how are we going to do things like, you know, measuring the thing. And of course, there are some specific algorithms that can be improved. And so there's a lot of reasons why you can kind of wave your hands around and say, okay, yeah, well, if I could have multi-state qudits, then I could clearly get some computational advantages if I can do everything as well as I could do with the qubits, with the two-level qubits. And that's a big if, obviously. So that's kind of the question that my research program is centered around right now. So I've been talking about, can we use a multiple qudit system to do something more efficiently or in some other way better than you could do with a multi-qubit system? But there's several steps that we need to get through first, and those are going to take us a while to accomplish. First of all, as I've alluded to, we need to be able to measure the qudits. We need to be able to implement the single qudit operations and the entangling operations, and then get all of that working in a large collection of qudits. And so for essentially the remainder of my talk, I want to give you an overview of how these experiments proceed, like what are the techniques that we use to manipulate ions. I'll be focused mostly on the qudits. So once I get to the steps where we're doing coherent manipulations, I'll be talking more about qudits than qubits. Hopefully I have given you enough background to think that it's not completely crazy to start doing experiments with multi-level qudits. And now we need to think about how are we going to actually do the experiments. So the first question you might ask when you go into an empty lab and say, how am I going to set up a trapped ion quantum computer in here? One of the first questions that you need is to know which ion you're going to use. Now, it happens that we use a lot of laser cooling techniques and other laser manipulation techniques, which are much easier when you have access to an atom with a single valence electron. So people who work with neutral atoms tend to like choosing from these purple columns here, the hydrogen-like alkali atoms. But in order to have an ion with a single valence electron, I'm going to pick from the second column of the periodic table. And I'm going to use one of these different isotopes highlighted in red here. It turns out that ytterbium is one of the very good qubit ions, but in my lab we're going to be using barium for reasons that I'll explain a little bit momentarily. So okay, I picked barium. What do I do now? Well, it would be nice if I made some ions. I would like to have an ion available to be able to trap it. So the way that we do that is we create an atomic beam. So I take a chunk of barium metal, I either heat it up, I blast it with a pulse of laser, light, whatever it is, and now I have neutral atoms spewing through my trap. And then I use lasers to liberate one of the electrons from that atom. So now I have an ion sitting in the middle of my trapping region, and hopefully I can do something quantum with it. And by the way, I hope this isn't too basic for everybody here, but I was told to make this beginning master's level talk, and so I'll just point out that if somehow you have missed a spectroscopy course or something like that, we're going to be making use of a lot of these type of level diagrams where I'm going to be saying, aha, I put a laser resonant with this transition, and what I really mean is that I'm choosing electromagnetic radiation whose frequency is equivalent to the energy difference between the two states, and then I can coherently drive them, or incoherently, depending on the details of how I set it up. So once we have the ions, it would be nice if they stayed put and didn't go flying off and smacking into the walls of our vacuum chamber. And as I mentioned earlier, the way that we do that is with electric fields. So we use a technique called a Paul trap, which makes use of the fact that even though you can't actually set up electric fields that will point towards the center of your trap from all directions, you're always going to have some kind of a saddle potential. You can still get around that little issue by changing the direction of your electric fields. So every time your ion is trying to roll off the side of your saddle potential, you flip the polarity so that you catch it again, and thereby wind up with a stable potential. So once we have the ions trapped, now we need to cool them and do other things with them, which involve laser manipulations. The structure of these ions that we typically use is something like this. We have a single valence electron. It can be in an s orbital, a p orbital. There's some interaction between its spin and orbital angular momentum and so on. And we're going to make use of this S to P transition for quite a lot of what we're doing. That's because the P states decay very fast. So I get, if I turn on a laser resonant with this transition, I scatter maybe a million or 10 million photons per second off of the ion. And that's where, for example, the images that I showed you on the first slide came from. In a lot of ions, moreover, we have these low-lying D states, and what's interesting about those is that because you need to lose 2 quanta of angular momentum to transition from D down to S, that doesn't happen very often. The photons only have 1 unit of angular momentum. And so the lifetimes of these states tend to be very long, and that's useful for reasons I'll get into in probably a slide or two. So I'm not going to talk too much about how we do the laser cooling. We set up this laser so that ions only absorb photons when they're traveling towards the laser beam, and that sort of exerts a force that slows them down. But once we have a cold ion and it's sitting in its trap, now we need to work on thinking about the DiVincenzo type criteria. We need to prepare states, we need to measure states, we need to manipulate our qubits. And most of this, unfortunately, is stuff that we need to rethink from scratch as compared to the trapped ion qubit experiments, or at least a little bit from scratch. And in this part of the talk, I will give you some estimates on the fidelities that we think might be achievable with these experiments. These are calculations that my students are doing, but here we're really just, we're playing a game that I call guess the limitations, right? So I'm going to tell you about, you know, this is something that we think is probably the most fundamental limitation that's hardest to beat, and we want to convince ourselves that we're not going to run into some fundamental wall that's going to limit us from ever doing anything useful. But I'm not giving you numbers that I think we will achieve in the experiments immediately. So I like giving disclaimers of that kind because I'm conservative that way. So, okay, you want to encode a qubit into a trapped ion. How are you going to do that? Typically, we're going to use ions that actually have a nuclear spin, and that means that the level structure of this ground electronic state has some hyperfine structure. I've sketched it here as though there's a weak magnetic field perturbing the states. So on the x-axis, I have the projection of the atom's angular momentum along the quantization axis. And on the vertical is the energy, not quite to scale. And for example, with the barium-137 ions that we're going to be using in my lab, we have 8 different states in this hyperfine manifold. They never really decay. And so the only real issue in terms of encoding quantum information in them is whether they're dephasing, whether the energy levels are shaking around. So if I want to do something like make a 3-level qubit, I pick 3 of those states, and I say, okay, these are my states 0, 1, and 2, whatever it is that I want to do. Now, with a qubit, we can take advantage of the fact that there are some pairs of states that don't shake around with magnetic fields, because magnetic field noise is the primary source of decoherence for us. And so if I want a qubit, 2 states, then I say, okay, I'm going to work with these m equals 0 states, and they don't really move around, and so now I'm going to have really great coherence times. That's where the 10-minute number I mentioned earlier came from. If I want to use more than 2, well, I can't do that, because there's only 2 states that have 0 sensitivity to magnetic field. So I am going to have to deal with more decoherence, and I'm going to have to give up on bragging about the 10-minute coherence record. Fortunately for me, though, we do think that the coherence times will be several seconds. If we can achieve the state-of-the-art magnetic field sensitivities, they will be around 5 seconds. And that's plenty long for most of what we want to do. So there's really not all that big of a problem, I suppose, to moving to multiple levels from that point of view. So hopefully our qubit is going to encode its information well, but we need to prepare it into some known state before we can do anything interesting with it. Fortunately, that's the one step that's exactly the same as for qubits. So we're going to use an optical pumping technique where we set up our lasers so that they always increment the angular momentum by 1 every time they excite the atom. And then eventually it walks its way down to this highest angular momentum state where there's no connection to an excited state. So now it's in a dark state. It doesn't respond to the laser, and it just sits there. So with that, we can prepare states with very high fidelity. We typically don't even measure what that is because we tend to worry more about the gate fidelities than the state preparation. Now, in an algorithm, the next step after you prepared your qubit would be to do some kind of coherent operations on it. A measurement wouldn't come till the end. But in the lab, the measurement is the first thing that we need because we don't know what the heck we're doing to the thing if we don't have a way to measure it. So the way that we do measurements, I kind of alluded to this earlier. If I have a qubit, it's not so hard. So remember I said if I apply a laser to this S to P transition, I scatter lots of photons. Well, if my ion is sitting in the S state, that is, that's true. If my ion is sitting in a D state, that laser doesn't resonate with any states. It doesn't scatter any photons. So I can do a binary measurement pretty simply. If I have a way to plunk my 0 state over in this D manifold, then I just turn on my laser and I say, do I have photons coming out or not? So that's all well and good for qubits, but it didn't really seem like the appropriate approach for qubits because you would like more than one bit of information. We're going to do this with basically the same idea, but we're just going to make it a little bit more complicated. So here I'm showing you part of the D manifold. This is the one that I said lives for half a minute. And before I turn on my measurement laser, I'm going to use a different laser, and I'm going to whoosh everything up into this dark state, except for one of the states that I want to measure. So now I turn on my fluorescence. I should probably have made that blue rather than red anyway. If my ion was in this state, I'll get fluorescence out. If not, I'll know it was in one of the other four in this case. And now if I want to learn which of the other four was it in, I seem to have duplicated my slide here by mistake, sorry about that. If I want to know which of the other four it was in, assuming there was no fluorescence, then I bring one back at a time and I check for fluorescence every time. So unfortunately, this is slow compared to doing a single measurement, and the fidelities aren't terrific. The limiting factor that we think is going to put an upper bound on our measurement fidelity is having to do with that transfer step, because our lasers aren't perfect. They don't have perfect line frequency stability and things like that. But we do calculate that for typical numbers, we'll get pretty high fidelity transfers between the states with just a single laser pulse. And then unfortunately, because we have multiple states, we have to do, you know, some non-zero, non-one number of these pulses, and your fidelity starts dropping as you add more and more states into your QDIT. But we still can achieve what are fairly high numbers with a fairly simple protocol. And I'm going to be saying this a couple more times as I come to the QDIT gates, the single QDIT and the entangling gates, but we do think that we're going to be able to do better than this if we start working on more sophisticated protocols. But ensuring that we don't have something limiting us to, say, 50% fidelity, that's already somewhat reassuring for us. I would say that achieving 99% measurement fidelity is pretty good, because that's at least comparable to what we can do with the qubits. So after we have our measurement protocol all set up, the next logical step is going to be to implement single QDIT gates. It turns out that somebody else has already solved the theoretical problem for us. You can synthesize any single QDIT unitary using these things that are sometimes called Givens rotations, and all they are is essentially Pauli sigma x and sigma y operators acting on a single pair of states. So as long as you can perform these on a connected graph between all your QDIT states, then you can synthesize any unitary that you want. The scaling is some d squared, something like that. But that's all fairly straightforward for us to do, because we can make sure that all of our QDIT states are separated by different frequencies. So when I go to do a single gate, I'm going to have to break it down into several operations. And the example I like to give is the generalization of the X gate. So what the X gate does is it takes 0, moves it to 1, it takes 1, moves it to 2, and so on, and then it wraps around it. When you apply X to 4, you get 0 again, or D minus 1, whatever you get. So the way that we're going to do that in the lab is we do a pulse that transfers, that swaps 3 and 4 on this transition. I can do that because this is at a different frequency than any of the other transitions happening in my manifold. Then I swap 2 and 3, and 1 and 2, and 0 and 1. And if you follow through with that and, you know, think about it just a second, you'll see that if I was in 0 or anything other than 4, my population only got moved once, and I got exactly what I expected here. And if I was in the 4 state, I walked down the ladder, and everything worked out fine. And you can decompose any single QDIT unitary like this. This is just an example. And with these, the typical limiting factor on single QDIT gate fidelities, single qubits, I should say, is the decoherence rate. from the magnetic field noise and so on. So there's some amount of decoherence that happens during the pulse that you turn on your laser. And those errors tend to be down in the 10 to the minus 6 level. And even if we have to do a whole bunch of rotations, it's never going to be enough to really take us above this 10 to the minus 4 level error rates. So that all seems pretty good. And the single qubit gates are not likely to be the limiting factor for us. So then the final thing that I want to talk about, the thing that's hardest for us, is the two qubit gates. We are able, on paper at least, to entangle two qubits in a similar way that we do with the qubits. And I'm going to walk you through first how we do entangling gates with trapped ion qubits. Then I'll show you how we generalize that to multiple level systems. And I'll give you one more disclaimer here that, because I'm a fan of disclaimers apparently today, that this is complicated enough material that I spent more than half of a graduate reading course teaching it to my grad students. And now I'm going to try to give you the 10-minute version. So I'll do my best. And I do encourage you to ask questions if I'm being completely unclear. And don't feel bad if you don't understand it as well, because it took my students 4 months to pick up on all the subtleties here. The very basic idea, the sort of hand-wavy argument for how we make the entanglement work, is we have ions that have a Coulomb interaction energy. And if we can apply a spin-dependent force to them, then we can get a spin-spin interaction from them. That's what this picture is depicting here. If my ions are in the same spin state and I apply a spin-dependent force, their interaction energy doesn't change. Their Coulomb interaction energy doesn't change. But if they're in different states, then all of a sudden they've been pulled apart more, then the Coulomb interaction energy differs. So the states with an up-down or a down-up set of spins are going to acquire a different phase while this force is applied than my up-up and down-down states. So it's basically a controlled phase gate in a different basis. And all we needed to do was to apply a force which was proportional to some spin operator, sigma x operator, or an SZ operator, or whatever it is that we like. Well, conveniently, there's a way for us to do that with our lasers. We like our lasers. And the idea is that we can set things up so that each of our two qubit states is shifted by a different amount in a different direction when we shine a laser onto them. So if I set up two laser beams then in a standing wave, then the intensity pattern is going to give me something where the potential for the spin up state looks like this blue curve, and the potential for the spin down state looks like this red curve. And so you can kind of convince yourself that if I had an ion sitting here or anywhere I like, then the spin up is going to get pushed one way, the spin down is going to get pushed the other way, just like I wanted for my entangling gate. Now, the next trick that we play is to cause this potential to oscillate in time. And that's fairly simple to do in the lab. We're just attuning a laser. But why am I bothering with that? Well, the idea here is just simply to drive a harmonic oscillator off resonance. I'm showing you here a phase space picture in a rotating frame. So in a non-rotating frame, you would have, for a harmonic oscillator, your p squared plus x squared, your kinetic energy plus your potential energy equals a constant. So you would have an ellipse going around here. But in a rotating frame, if I do nothing to the oscillator, it's just going to sit wherever it is in phase space. Now, when I apply a detuned force, then I'm going to kind of excite the motion and then de-excite it again. Just simple classical mechanics. And the reason why that's relevant is that the motion of the ions is essentially harmonic. So what you get when you take the motion of the ions and take into account the fact they're in a harmonic trap, you take into account their interactions with each other, as you get this spectrum of normal modes where all of these are collective modes where all the ions are moving together, and they're all at different frequencies. And what I mean by a normal mode is essentially, like, if I excite the center of mass mode, it's not going to start making the ion chain tip around and exciting these other modes. It's really just going to be only exciting this one mode.
So picture gives an impression of atoms being in a circle. That's not so. Only the two sublattices move out of phase.
You're referring to this picture here. Yes, so this is what we would refer to as the zigzag mode, where every other ion gets displaced opposite to each other. Okay, so the hand-wavy description I gave you of the spin-dependent force earlier is a little bit misleading. What we're really doing is we're manipulating these normal modes. So if you imagine now, I'm going to go back to my standing wave, but I just have a different picture of it now, showing you that they're both ions are sitting at the same place in this moving standing wave. So now the way I've set things up is if I tune the frequency of this force close to the frequency of my center of mass mode, then I really only excite that one. I'm not going to excite the others very much. So I'll just ignore the other modes for the moment. So if I'm trying to excite the center of mass mode and I'm pushing the ions in the same direction, then I can easily excite that mode. That makes sense. But if they're in different spin states and they're getting pushed in different directions, I'm actually not going to excite the mode because push them like this, and they don't want to do this, roughly speaking. So when I do that, what happens is that if my ions are in the same state, they start getting pushed around in phase space. They execute these circles. If they're in different states, they just stay put. They don't get pushed around at all. And the effect of that is that the states which are being displaced pick up a geometric phase. So this is where we have to go beyond the hand-wavy classical mechanics picture, because the phase that you're picking up is from the displacement operator on the coherent state. So it's really it's not a classical phenomenon so much. And the cool thing about this idea, though, is we can do the same exact thing with a multi-level qubit. But now we're just going to do this with a larger spin operator. So way back a few slides ago, I had a Hamiltonian where my force was proportional to a sigma x for a spin half operator. Now I'm just going to set it up so that it's proportional to an sx, a higher dimensional spin, which is very doable. And then I'm going to have a situation where different pairs of states pick up different phases in such a way that we get some weird looking control phase type of a situation. So each state acquires this phase proportional to the area enclosed by its little loopy thing in phase space. Now, describing the mechanism of the most common errors in this this picture is a little bit difficult to do mathematically. Well, I guess, anyway, the primary source of error is that way back here, I was saying that my Hamiltonian is proportional to x. And what I was really doing is I was linearizing this harmonic potential. So the fact that it's not actually a linear potential, it's a harmonic potential, causes deviations from this perfect cartoon that I can draw. And so we get errors resulting from that I won't try to describe in too much detail. But you can kind of see them, for example, when we simulate the dynamics of a pair of three-level qubits. Each of these yellow dashed lines here represents a point where these circles in phase space have all closed again. And that's actually an important point, is that we need for all of the states to come back to where they started in phase space. If we have spin motion entanglement left behind in the system, that's another source of errors, and we want to get rid of that. So we want to make sure that we always drive exactly one circle. So my first circle, if you don't know what you're looking at, then you say, okay, that looks totally fine. But as you follow these dynamics further along, it becomes obvious that what should be happening here is my red and my blue curves should be meeting up at 50% here after two cycles, after six cycles, and so on. They're kind of growing away from each other. So I don't have a better picture than that, unfortunately, but I guess this is just to show that we are able to simulate what type of errors we think we're going to get before I throw some numbers at you and say, okay, yeah, we can totally do good fidelity gates with at least three level qudits and probably five levels as well. So with that, I chose to leave out the section where I talked about my graduate work because it was always kind of shoehorned in there anyway. So today all I really wanted to tell you about is we're building a cool trapped ion lab. You're going to be excited to see pictures of the ions someday soon, I hope. We have protocols developed that we know how to do all of the basic operations that we will need for performing quantum computing with the qudits. We also have estimates now suggesting that we can perform these operations with decent fidelities, which is going to be important if we ever want to push this in the direction of quantum error correction or anything like that. And hopefully, the next time that I see you all, I'll have some preliminary data so that I don't have to resort to hand-waving and cartoon pictures, and we'll have experimental numbers on how well we can do these things. So with that, I'd like to obviously thank everybody who gives me money, but also the people working in my group who've done most of the work that I showed, and the other ION group at IQC, which is also fairly closely involved in the experimental buildup. And with that, I'll stop there and take any questions.
So the ionic motion, you are treating them semi-classically as classical motion.
Yes.
So is there any situations where you could treat them quantum mechanically, like the phonons of this?
You can treat the motion quantum mechanically. In fact, we usually cool the ions to the ground state or close to the ground state before performing any of these quantum operations. And there's a small cottage industry in creating funky non-classical phonon states. That's something that we can do with these laser potentials. You can imagine that if I can push the ions around, I can engineer ways of adding or subtracting phonons from the system.
I have a short question. Do you have any advantage of using molecular ions? Because you have more degree of freedom, like rotational.
Molecular ions would certainly have more degrees of freedom. In fact, maybe a little bit too many. The way these things usually go is that we carve down the complexity of the experiment as much as we possibly can. We find the simplest possible system. We learn how to control that. And then, as in this example where I'm going from two states to maybe three or four or five, then once I've got the really simple stuff down, I start thinking about adding more complexity. So I would say molecular ions would be another step beyond what we're trying to do here. Even more complications that you need to think about with the laser cooling and so on.
Do the people in the world, I mean, the rest of the community, are there efforts to do molecular ions?
Yes, so there are several groups that are working with molecular ions. Most of them right now are doing spectroscopy and laser cooling. So these are sort of the preliminary steps that I mostly skimmed over in my talk, because with the ions I'm using, we already know all of the details. What does the energy structure look like? How do we cool the ions down?
question regarding your measurement of the N-level system.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought that, you know, for large N, it might have made sense to break it up, not into, you know, is it this level or not, is it this level or not, but, you know, just, you know, figure out which half of the levels, you know, first bifurcate the levels, you know, mm-hmm. This half, is it kind of Newton's method. Are there reasons why you can't do that in the setup you have, or?
There are reasons why it's difficult, certainly. So if I go back to that slide real quick, in this setup that I showed where I had this state fluorescing, what I didn't show you is that as soon as I turn on the laser, I kind of scramble the information around the entire hyperfine manifold. It can decay from this upper state back into any of these three states on the first try, let's say, and then it gets excited and it can, you know, execute a random walk all over hyperfine space. So that's problematic if I have more than one state in there and I want to be able to discriminate between them later, because now, you know, you don't know which one walked in which direction without capturing every single photon that came out of the atom, which isn't practical.
That means you could, for example, if you have like an even number, and as an even number, you could easily do the measurement just as in this half of the levels, this half of the levels. You didn't want to follow that up with other...
Yes, if you only want to know, was it, let's say, in a positive or a negative projection of angular momentum, you can do that much more easily. That's true. The question is really going to depend on the details of what information you're trying to extract. Because if you do want full information about which eigenstate the ion was in, you've lost that capability, but maybe for some things you don't care about that. And this actually is a point that we kind of make in my graduate work. So if I show you real quick that slide, we were doing an experiment where we expected to... We were making a situation where both the plus and the minus states would fluoresce, and we wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them. But the state that we thought we were going to make was such that it didn't really matter, because we could tell that we were not making any of the wrong states. There are some other examples like that, but it's all going to depend on the details of what you're trying to measure.
You might be able to show some interesting things, like, you know, in qubit models, the ability to measure even a single output qubit can be helpful. So in your context, being able to not do the full measurement on a qubit, but just mm-hmm. a measurement that essentially is of a qubit subsystem of your qubit could still be handy for something.
I could certainly imagine it being handy, yeah. I don't know the specific examples where it would be, though.
Other questions for Crystal?
And if you have level degeneracies, then I imagine that you would get the geometric phase would be non-abelian.
Probably so. I haven't thought about that case very much.
Well, I was just going to ask whether you had thought about it, because experimental verification of non-abelian geometric phases is we don't know much about it, so I was wondering whether your setup would help.
It isn't something I've thought about at all, but I'd certainly be interested to hear more about what you would want to see and measure, and perhaps there's a way that we could do it in a system. I don't know.
Okay, there's no further questions, and before we thank Crystal one more time, let me just remind you there's snacks downstairs in the future. Thanks again.